Hello and welcome to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Thanks for being with us. We've got 2 hours of open forum today. Jimmy Akin, our guest. That means you can call with any question you've got, 888-318-7884. And don't let the name of the program fool you. You don't have to be Catholic to call. Anybody can call, 888-318-7884. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of quite a few different books, including the one I have right here in my hand, The Bible is a Catholic Book, one of his more recent books, also the proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World on the internet. Hi, Jimmy Akin.
Hi, Cy Kellett.
I'm kind of dying to ask you a question. I said something about 4-H to Nick before the show, and he didn't know what 4-H is. Did you ever do 4-H as a kid?
Oh, yeah. Well, I had contact with it. I'll put it that way. I don't know that I was ever a member of it. But yeah, I was familiar with 4-H. It was a youth organization that, and it may still be out there, but it was a youth organization that promoted various values among kids. The H's were for things like health, heart, things like that.
Hands, I think, was one of them, too.
Hands it was, like, was one of them.
Yeah. But I always knew them as the kids that raised animals. And I was so jealous of them that they got to raise a, you know, they would get to raise like a steer or a pig or something. I thought that was the coolest thing in the world. But
yeah, they had an agricultural orientation, kind of like Future Farmers of America.
Yeah. See, Nick knew Future Farmers of America, but he didn't know 4-H. I figured Jimmy would probably know. 888-318-7884, our number, 888-31-TRUTH. Although Nick did tell me that in Texas where he grew up in the suburbs. He didn't grow up around cattle, I guess. Is that right? Yeah. Hmm. Did you grow up around?
Yeah. Well, it depends on what level of growing up around you mean. But yes, my my grandparents owned a ranch that I and my sibs have inherited part of. And we would go down every summer and pick up a cow that had been slaughtered for us, and that would get us, you know, beef for the year. We'd bring it back in dry ice, and when we get back to Arkansas, we'd play with the dry ice. And when we'd go down for visits in the summers, we would be put to work with the cows, you know, getting them hay and rounding them up and putting them back in their appointed fields when they got out of them and things like that.
I had an uncle who had a farm. I think it's just one of the best things. Yeah, we never got to really, I mean, you know, a few days we'd stay and get to feed the cattle. But I just think it's great for you. I love that. Mm-hmm.
Our farm even had a name.
Akin Acres. No.
At some point, this was my mom's side of the family, so that Akin wasn't the name. But at some point, my grandmother determined that she wanted to get all of the thistles off of the farm, and so she and others in the family uprooted all of the thistles, and it became known thereafter as Thistle Free Farm.
Oh, that's a nice name, Thistle. I can't say it, but Thistle Free Farm. That's nice.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I forgot. I did do some farming when I was a teenager. I worked on a Christmas tree farm. That was so easy to get them all together and keep them. None of them ever got out of the pen. It was very easy farming.
Christmas trees are easy that way. We also in Arkansas, we also, you know, farmed vegetables and had chickens for a while and things like that.
But no 4-H animals.
No. You,
every line full now. And Reed is first up in North Carolina, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Hi, Reed. You there with us?
Yes, sir.
How old are you, Reed?
My question for you. 9 years old.
Well, you're very welcome here. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
Why did God make the devil?
Well, God made the devil like he made everything because it originally was good. The devil originally was a good angel. And one of the good things about the devil, like us, is God gave him free will. Unfortunately, and free will is a good thing because having free will allows us to love God in a different way than like just being a robot who's programmed to act lovingly. It allows us to freely choose love. But because it involves a free choice, we can also misuse free will. And that's what we humans do when we sin. And it's what the devil did when he fell away from God. But fundamentally, the devil was originally good, just like human beings. And so God made him for that reason.
What do you think, Reed?
I understand, sir.
Well, that's good. That's what we aim for.
Both my sisters have a question. My older sister's name is Nora. My younger sister's name is Mary. Do we need to call back, or can we do it now?
Well, because I have a lot of people on the line, maybe you could just hang on, and we'll mix your sisters in when we've got a moment. Would that be okay, Reed, or is that going to be too hard for you?
That would be fine, sir.
Okay. You're such a gentleman, Reed. I really like you. Just hang on the line, and we'll put you on hold, and we'll come back for one of your sisters as spaces open up. Thanks, Reed. Let's go to Nate in Dallas, Texas. Our old friend Nate. I'm pretty sure. I don't know that many Nates in Dallas, Texas. Nate in Dallas, Texas, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hey, good afternoon. It's me. How are y'all?
Very well.
Good. I have a question about the Council of Laodicea in the 4th century. And am I saying that correctly?
It's often said cool. Laodicea, but it doesn't really matter.
Laodicea. Okay. The Christians, the 29th canon says, quote, Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day. Rather, honoring the Lord's day and, if they can, resting then as Christians. But if any shall be found to be Judaizers, let them be anathema from Christ, end quote. So my question is, what did they mean by Judaizing? Was it an attempt, was Judaizing an attempt by Jews to introduce their customs to pagan converts to Christianity? Or was it the mixing of Christian and Jewish practices by Jewish converts? Like, if you were ethnically a Jew and you converted to Christianity, but you were still keeping some of your old customs, was that? And also, were you allowed to still keep the Sabbath so long as you also kept the Lord's Day?
Like have a weekend?
So the answer to the question is probably a little more complex than I can do justice to in the time available. But basically, it's been understood, what Judaizing is has been understood different ways at different points in church history by different people. Some would consider any observance of Jewish customs to be Judaizing. Others would say, no, it's not any observance of Jewish customs, but it's doing them out of a religious motive, thinking that you need to do this Jewish thing in order to please God. And that's the view that would cohere best with the modern Catholic understanding of things, that thinking, okay, I've got to keep the Sabbath on Saturday in order to be pleasing to God, that would be an unacceptable form of Judaizing because Christians are not bound to keep the Sabbath. And so that's what the contemporary understanding would be, that Christians are not obliged to observe the Mosaic law, including its Sabbath requirement. But we are to observe what Paul refers to in the Corinthian letters as the law of Christ, which is the Christian equivalent of the law of Moses that includes basic morality as well as the special ritual provisions that Christ made for us, things like baptism and observing the Lord's Day on Sunday and so forth.
Nate, I hope that's helpful. We'll leave it there. We'll take our first break, as a matter of fact, and we'll come right back. Before I send you off to the break, we do have free shipping on bulk cases of our two top best-selling titles, Why We're Catholic and The Bible is a Catholic Book. Why We're Catholic, of course, by Trent Horn, and The Bible is a Catholic Book by our own guest today, Jimmy Akin. The limit is 3 cases per title. That means you can reach out to 60 of your closest friends and family and fellow parishioners. So this is a flash sale, so you're going to want to do this soon. You just go over to shop.catholic.com, buy in bulk, and it's a savings of $10 a case right now on our two best-selling books, the Why We're Catholic and The Bible is a Catholic Book.
Catholic Answers Live.
Hi, this is Cy. Catholic Answers Focus is our podcast, and it's meant to help you live, understand, and defend your Catholic faith. And it's fun because we get to drill down on one topic for each episode with someone who really knows their stuff. This week, for example, we have an episode with Chris Check on the Inquisition, and we have an entire episode dedicated to sharing the faith with people who just don't seem to care about God. You can get Focus wherever you get your podcasts. You can watch it on YouTube, or you can visit our website, CatholicAnswersFocus.com.
Want the latest pro-life news? Want it delivered? Sign up. It's free. EWTN Pro-Life Weekly, your source for everything happening now in the fight to protect the sanctity of human life. New episodes delivered every week to your inbox. So if you really want to know,
sign up today.
Go to EWTN.com/pro-life today.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live, Tuesday, 2 hours of open forum. Our guest, Jimmy Akin, senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. And on the line all the way from Australia is Peter, listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Peter, thank you so much for your call. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Good morning. My question is about Hildegard von Bingen and how she became a doctor of the church. I know she was a polymath. She did work in a great number of fields. But what was it that put her over the finishing line to become a doctor of the church?
So my understanding is that there isn't a single contribution that Hildegard of Bingen made, that it was a mix of the different things she did, because as you mentioned, she was a polymath, and some of the things that she did, weren't fully religious in their orientation. I mean, like she wrote a book about herbs and how they could be used for healing and things like that, in accord with the ideas of the medical science of the day. And that's not really a theological contribution. It's just something interesting that she did. She also had writings in what is referred to as an unknown language. And that also, it appears to be what's called a conlang today, a constructed language that she invented. And that's also an interesting, nice thing that she did, but it's not really a theological contribution. My understanding is that her theological and mystical writings played more of a role in why she's a doctor of the church. But that's a general impression that I would have to do further documentation on or further research on to see if I could document it more precisely.
But thank you for saying good morning from Australia. I appreciate it, Peter. Thanks for the call. I hope that was helpful to you. Let's go to Brighton, Michigan now. Listening on Ave Maria Radio is Dominic. Dominic, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi, Mr. Akin. I was recently reading on an article on Catholic.com about the Septuagint and its translation and the origins of that, and it seems that it comes from the between the 2nd and 3rd century BC, which is interesting because I thought that the Maccabees happened in the mid 2nd century BC, which could make the Septuagint older than the Maccabees. And I just found that interesting.
Is the Septuagint older than the Maccabees, Jimmy?
Well, it depends on what you mean by the Septuagint and older and the Maccabees. It's kind of, to sketch a parallel, it's like, is the Bible older than the Gospels? Well, parts of the Bible are older than the Gospels. You know, Genesis was written before the Gospels were. But if you mean the Bible as a whole, well, no, it wasn't complete until the Gospels had been written, because the Gospels are part of the Bible. And in the same way, parts of the Septuagint, which is the major Greek translation of the Old Testament, are older than the time of the Maccabees, according to the evidence we have. And there's some uncertainty about this, but the primary source that we have about the origin of the Septuagint is a document called the Letter of Aristeas, and scholars debate exactly how accurate it is. But one of the things that the Letter of Aristeas says is that in the time of Pharaoh Ptolemy II Philadelphus, so he's one of the Greek pharaohs of Egypt after the Greeks took over, and he's also associated with the Library of Alexandria, the famous, you know, big library there, that he wanted a translation of the Jewish law of the books of Moses. And so he hired a group of 70 Jewish scholars to translate those books for him. And that's why it's called the Septuagint, after the Latin word for 70, the 70 scholars who did the translation of the law of Moses. And so this indeed would have been, you know, somewhere around the year 260 BC, which is about 100 years before the time of the Maccabees. The Maccabees are around and active around the 160, around 160 BC. So the first part of the Septuagint, the translation of the Law of Moses, that does look like it's older than the Maccabees, just like Genesis looks older than the Gospels. But if you mean the entire collection of the Septuagint, well, no, that includes the Maccabees, and it includes Wisdom, which is probably the last of the books to be written, either sometime, it's sometime around the year, if there were a year zero, it's around there, plus or minus 50 years. Mm-hmm. The Septuagint as a whole, if you mean, is the Septuagint as a whole older than the Maccabees? No, because it continued to be translated and written until after the books of the Maccabees were done. The same way, if you said, is the Bible as a whole older than the Gospels? The answer would be no, because the Bible continued to be written and wasn't complete until after the Gospels had been written.
Dominic, thanks. I appreciate that question. Thank you very much. I hope that was helpful for you. I'm going to go back to North Carolina and check in, see if any of Reed's sisters want to ask a question. Mary, are you there with us?
Yes, sir.
Hello, Mary. How old are you?
Six.
Well, we're very happy that Reed called and put you on the line. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Aiken.
Well, my question was, why didn't the Pharisees believe Jesus after they saw all the signs? And why did they hate him?
Well, so some of them did believe in Jesus after they saw him perform various signs. You know, Joseph of Arimathea was a Pharisee, and he was a follower of Jesus. Nicodemus was a Pharisee, and he was a follower of Jesus. So many of the Pharisees did actually come to believe in Jesus, but a lot of them also didn't. And the reason for that is humans have free will. They can make choices about what they're going to believe and what they're not going to believe. And even if you see a miracle, that doesn't mean you're going to understand it correctly. You might say, well, I don't believe that this man is from God, therefore what he did must not have been a genuine miracle. It must have been something else. Maybe it's like a magician's trick, or maybe a demon helped him do it, or something like that. And in fact, we have indications in the Gospels that some of the Pharisees were saying things like that about Jesus. Now, we know that's not true, because Jesus also did things that no demon could ever perform and that no magician could ever perform, like coming back from the dead and ascending into heaven in front of all of his disciples. So we know, based on our complete knowledge of what's in the Bible, that Jesus's miracles were true. But at the time, if you just saw one of them or a few of them, you could, if you chose, you could try to dismiss it, especially if you hated someone. And that connects to your second question, why did they hate him? They hated him for a variety of reasons. One of them is they viewed him as a threat, because a lot of people were believing in Jesus and were questioning ideas that the Pharisees had. And Jesus could be critical of some of the things the Pharisees were doing. You know, he calls them hypocrites at times. And that would, you know, mean some of them wouldn't like Jesus, because people don't like being called hypocrites. Also, they don't like losing their followers to someone else. And there's also another reason, which is that they were afraid that Jesus was going to start a rebellion against the Romans, and that the Romans were going to come in and just completely conquer Israel and destroy their temple and things like that. And we actually see, if you look in John chapter 11, we see that's one of the concerns that the high priest Caiaphas has about Jesus. He's afraid Jesus is going to start a rebellion and they're going to lose the war and it's going to make things worse.
Okay, Mary?
Yes, sir.
All right. Tell Nora she's next. We're going to do a few more calls and then we'll come back to Nora for her question. I hope that was helpful to you, Mary. Let's go to Holly in Indiana, listening on Catholic.com. Glad to have you, Holly. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hello. Thank you so much for taking my call. Your show has been a real blessing in my life this past year, so I thank you for that.
Oh, thank you.
So I'm wondering about the first reading from this past Sunday from Genesis chapter 22 with the command for Abraham to sacrifice Isaac. My pastor said that there was no way God literally commanded Abraham to kill his only son, but that Abraham simply imagined or misunderstood that such a sacrifice would be pleasing to God because of, say, his pagan surroundings. Is there a legitimate way to interpret the passage that way? Because it struck me as odd the way that he said that. So I wanted to get your thoughts on that.
Yeah, I would say that there are ways to understand Genesis 22 non-literally, that, you know, this is meant to show the audience something other than what you might take it to mean at first reading, but I wouldn't do it the way your priest did. The text depicts Abraham as receiving an instruction from God to sacrifice Isaac as a test to see, is he really following God, or does he care more about his son Isaac than he does about God? And there's nothing in this text that suggests Abraham misunderstood the command that he received. There are other later passages, like in the book of Hebrews, that suggest Abraham may have thought, I will sacrifice Isaac, and then God will bring him back from the dead. The author of Hebrews talks about that. If you look in Hebrews chapter 11, it talks about how Abraham, who went to sacrifice Isaac, considered God able to raise the dead. And so since Abraham knew that his descendants were going to be reckoned through Isaac, if he sacrifices Isaac, well, then how's that going to happen unless God brings him back from the dead? And so that's one way that the text has been understood. Another way that the text has been understood, because this was written long after the events, is to show us a couple of lessons, but we're not meant to take the passage fully literally. One of the lessons is you need to follow God above all else. You know, as Jesus said, you need to care more about him than, you know, your ultimate loyalty needs to be to him, not to your own family. And that we see that in the case of Abraham and Isaac. But also, because the Israelites were later tempted to commit child sacrifice, because that was a practice that the Canaanites had and some Israelites participated in it, that this is the author of Genesis's way of showing the Israelites, no, you do need to be loyal to God above all, but God does not want you to sacrifice your children to him. And that's why he ultimately rejects the sacrifice of Isaac and provides an alternative.
Okay, Holly?
Yeah, so that does make sense, and I have heard some of those points of view before. The one thing that, I guess, if I could have a follow-up, one question came up about kind of one of the priest's objections to it being to any sort of literal reading was that God would never command his people to kill another person, but that confused me too, because I actually literally just the other day read an account in Deuteronomy with King Sihon, if I'm saying that right, with his defeat and everything, where God did command the Israelites to go into battle.
Holly, so, I'm going to let, because there's limited time, just let Jimmy address that. What about God commanding?
So, there's also a question about how literal those passages are meant to be. There are ways of taking them literally. In fact, the historic majority opinion has been that those passages, including the sacrifice of Isaac, are to be taken literally. And the justification that people like Thomas Aquinas would offer is that all life is a gift of God, And therefore, it's up to God how much of that gift you get, and therefore, when your life ends and the means by which your life ends is something that God can appropriately determine. And so, although we have not been given carte blanche to take innocent life or to take life, God can determine when a person's life is going to end and whether you're going to be the instrument through which that happens. And if God gives permission or commands it in a particular case, that it is morally legitimate in those cases. So there's these different ways of taking these passages, and the church has not ruled definitively on which way, if any of the ones we've mentioned, is correct.
Holly, thank you. I'm glad we've gotten to accompany you this year. I hope that will go on. Appreciate the call. Maybe you'll call back again sometime. Right now, we have to take a break. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's open forum. You can ask anything you want to ask. The number is 888-318-7884. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, ready to take your questions. And you know what? When Jimmy's here, you can really ask anything. Really, anything. Try it. Right back.
Stay with us for more Catholic Answers Live.
Why does everyone need to be saved? Does the Bible say we're saved by faith alone and not by works? What does the Catholic Church teach about heaven, hell, and purgatory? In 20 Answers Salvation, you'll find smart, solid answers to these questions and many more, laying out the beautiful story of how God calls us out of sin, justifies us, makes us holy, and leads us to everlasting life with Him. 20 Answers Salvation is part of the 20 Answers series from Catholic Answers, offering hard facts, powerful arguments, and clear explanations of the most important topics facing the Church and the world, all in a compact, easy-to-read package. Visit shop.catholic.com today and take a look at this exciting new series from Catholic Answers Press.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
To many people, even many Christians, purgatory is a fantasy, or worse, a wicked lie invented by the church to make salvation complicated and keep people in fear. But I'm here to tell you that purgatory is fact, not fiction. The Bible supports it, Christians have historically believed in it, and it makes theological sense. In my new book, Purgatory is for Real, I provide the evidence and reasoning to help you understand this controversial doctrine and demonstrate how it's actually a joyful, hopeful reality, not something shadowy and mysterious, but a sign of God's love and mercy. To get your copy of Purgatory is for Real, visit shop.catholic.com today or ask for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Boy, lines have been staying full. Lots of folks on the line for Jimmy Akin, our senior apologist. Jimmy, of course, proprietor of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. And in this week's episode of Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, will the Delta Force be fighting aliens?
That would be a spoiler, but I can tell you the Delta Force was in the 1980s involved in an operation that was somehow connected with an alien invasion.
And that's what it is this time, right? It's the second part.
Last Friday, we told most of the story of Paul Benowitz, an inventor from New Mexico and a scientist who became convinced he was seeing evidence of alien infiltration, and he reported that to the Air Force, and they encouraged him in his studies. And now we're going to tell what happened and how Delta Force was involved and the terrible price that Paul himself paid.
Oh, I didn't know that last part. All right. Do you ever get like a suggestion for Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World and it's something you actually never have heard of before? Like you're like, I didn't even know that one. And it,
you know, periodically.
Because I know that people are probably, there's certain things that you're, hey, Jimmy, have you ever done the Bermuda Triangle? but I was just wondering if you ever like learn a new one.
Yeah, no, sometimes, well, I mean, I'm always learning because I'm always researching, but in terms of suggestions, we do occasionally get suggestions like, oh, this is one I'm not familiar with, and I'll check it out, and if it looks promising, I'll add it to the list of almost 1,500 items that I have in a spreadsheet for future topics.
Whoa, that is mysterious. That's I didn't even know the world had 1,500 mysteries.
Oh, yeah, way more.
Wow. All right. Back to the phones. Dorothy in Medford, Oregon, listening on the great Modern Day Radio. You know, Modern Day Radio is one of the oldest Catholic radio stations in America. Dorothy, go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Hi. I have a new friend that's Jehovah's Witness, and we've had some really good conversations. The first one was about the cross versus the stake, because I was wearing a cross. But the thing I'm stuck on, I've always believed and been taught that your soul departs at death. If you are perfect, which no one is, hardly, you go to heaven. You go to purgatory to cleanse yourself. Maybe then go to heaven.
Or and to be cleansed.
Yes, to be cleansed. That would be nice. And then at the second coming, we are reunited with our soul and to live in paradise or to live in heaven. That I'm not clear. They believe that the soul is just you, just your thoughts, your feelings, it's just you. And when your body dies, the soul is also dead.
All right, let's get...
And that...
I think we got... So what happens when you die, and how do you respond to a Jehovah's Witness who says your soul just dies?
So the first thing to recognize is that the term soul, and there's a different word for it in Greek and in Hebrew because the Bible isn't all in one original language, but the concept of soul gets used in more than one way in Scripture. And sometimes you can find language that would suggest that souls are not conscious between death and resurrection, because it talks in various places about how the dead know nothing and things like that, or that they're asleep or things like that. Really, that language should not be pressed, because we have other passages that indicate that the dead do continue to have conscious experience. And so you've got to figure out how, because Scripture is true, how can both of these types of passages represent a truth? Well, it's easy to explain the passages that talk about the dead sleeping as not being literal, because we often use sleep as a metaphor for death. It's a euphemism that makes the unpleasant reality of death less unpleasant. And so, you know, parents may tell their children, "Grandma has gone to sleep," or something like that, when really grandma has died. And so even in our own culture, we do that. And dead people look like they're sleeping. You know, they're not standing up. They're not walking around. They're laying down, typically, and their eyes are typically closed. And so they look like they're asleep. So it's natural to use sleep as a metaphor for death. On the other hand, it's harder to explain these passages that we have, which indicate that the dead continue to be conscious between death and resurrection. And there are a variety of such passages, both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. For example, in the historical books in the Old Testament, in the book of Samuel, forget if it's 1st or 2nd Samuel, but in Samuel, at one point, the King Saul uses a medium to summon the spirit of the dead prophet Samuel, and he has a conversation with the king. Now, I haven't checked to see what Jehovah's Witnesses make out of this. What some people will claim is, oh, this can't be Samuel, it must be a demon. But that's not what the text says. The text says it's Samuel. And in fact, later on in the book of Sirach, which Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe is Scripture, but in Sirach it confirms that that really was Samuel. Also, in 2 Maccabees, which Jehovah's Witnesses don't believe in Scripture, we have the leader Judah Maccabee receiving a vision of the dead high priest Onias and the dead prophet Jeremiah, who are praying for the people of Israel in the afterlife. And so there again, at least in the Catholic Bible, we have another indication that the souls of departed human beings continue to be conscious in the afterlife. And then in the New Testament, in the book of Revelation, we have when John is caught up to see the scene that's going on in heaven, he sees the souls that are under the altar in heaven that have been martyred and they're calling out to God for justice. He also sees other souls of people that are coming up out of the Great Tribulation. And all of this, again, is evidence of souls of departed human beings continuing to have conscious experience even before the resurrection of the dead.
Dorothy, I'm going to leave it there. I hope that's helpful to you because there's just a lot of folks on the line. Thank you very much for the question. Let's go to Security Colorado. Cecilia, watching on Facebook Live, you are next. Cecilia, go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Hello. So nice to talk to you guys again. My question is, during the liturgy of the Eucharist, we used to hear the word cup. Now we're hearing the word chalice. So why the change?
So the Latin word for both is calyx, and calyx can mean either cup or chalice or goblet. It can even mean water regulator. So it has rather a broad range of possible meanings. Now, in this case, we know it doesn't mean water regulator. It's obvious from the context of the liturgy that it means something like cup, chalice, or goblet. And so the question is, which of those are you going to pick? Well, In the 1970s, when the previous version of the liturgy was translated, there was a philosophy that of translation that wanted to make the Mass and the language of the Mass sound as informal as possible. The idea was sort of you want to reach people where they're at by using perfectly ordinary street English. Well, the word chalice is not part of perfectly ordinary street English, but the word cup is. And so out of a desire to try to relate the Mass to people's ordinary daily experience, the word cup got picked. But eventually, you know, it was realized that that's not necessarily the best translation philosophy to use in liturgy, because liturgy is not about ordinary daily experience. Liturgy is about an elevated form of experience where we lift our hearts and minds to God. That's why, you know, the Mass is different than a dinner party. It is formal. It is solemn. It invokes God in all kinds of different ways. And of course, Jesus really becomes present in the Mass in a way that doesn't happen in an ordinary dinner party. And it's appropriate to commemorate that fact using an elevated form of language. And so when the revised translation of the Mass came out in the year 2010, it was decided to use the more elevated term chalice rather than the more ordinary term cup to reflect the fact that this is not meant to be ordinary daily experience, but an elevated form of experience.
Thanks, Cecilia. Hope it was helpful. We're heading back to North Carolina. I think Nora is on the line in North Carolina. Nora, are you there with us?
Yes, sir.
And hello. You're the big sister, right, Nora?
Yes, sir.
And how old are you, Nora?
I'm 12.
Well, you've obviously set a great example for Reed and Mary because you're all so polite. Go ahead with your question for Mr. Akin.
My question is, what does Jesus mean when he says in the chapter of Luke, give to Caesar what is Caesar's and give to God what is God's?
So let's talk about the context in which this occurred. At the time, there was a debate in Jewish circles in Jesus' day about whether it was okay to pay taxes to Caesar, because Caesar was a pagan emperor and he didn't believe in God, at least not the way he should. And he did a bunch of bad things, including idolatry and oppressing different people. And so some Jewish people thought you should not pay taxes to Caesar. On the other hand, some Jews thought, no, you can and you should. And so you have these groups of people come to Jesus to try to trap him. And they ask, is it okay for us to pay taxes to Caesar or not? And some of them are hoping that he's going to start a revolution against the Romans, and he's going to say, of course you can't pay taxes to Caesar, in which case he's just committed treason and they can grab him. And so on the other hand, if he says, well, yes, you can pay taxes to Caesar, then that will offend other Jewish people who would want to say, well, maybe no, you shouldn't, because we have a religious duty to God rather than Caesar. And so that could hurt Jesus by costing him followers. And so they're trying to trap him no matter what he says. Either the Romans can grab him for treason or he's going to lose followers. And what Jesus very neatly does is he calls for a coin, a denarius. That was the type of coin they used. And just like we have George Washington on our quarters, they would have the picture of Caesar on their denarii, on their coins. And so he says, well, whose picture is on the denarius? And they say Caesar's. And because of the year this was happening, we know it would have been Tiberius Caesar. And by the way, I have a replica of that coin. But he says, well, okay, if it's got Caesar's image on it, then it must be Caesar's coin. So give to Caesar what belongs to him, but also give to God what belongs to God. So Jesus recognizes you can have responsibilities both ways. Since Caesar mints the coins, it's in some sense Caesar's coin. So yes, you can pay him taxes, but that doesn't mean you can neglect your duties to God. And so that's basically what Jesus is saying here, that we need to balance our responsibilities towards other human beings with our responsibilities towards God, which are the ultimate ones. But that doesn't mean we can neglect our human responsibilities.
Nora, thank you, and your brother and your sister and whoever else is there with you. That's been a great pleasure to talk with you. I hope that that was helpful to you. We got to take a quick break. We'll be right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin right after this.
There's only one Catholic Answers Live.
Do you love praying for people? Have you ever wanted to use your gift of prayer to share Jesus with others and build up the body of Christ? Start a public prayer station with St. Paul Street Evangelization. Listen to people's needs, pray with them, or invite them to meet you at church. St. Paul Street Evangelization can help you get started. Find out how at streetevangelization.com. That's streetevangelization.com.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Ever feel like life is just too busy, too much? Constant noise, social and traffic, work, paying bills, it just doesn't seem to let up. Well, maybe it's time for a change. God offers us relief and hope. So if you're feeling like you need more peace and less chaos, then find your hope today. Begin at CatholicsComeHome.com.
Just the luck of the draw. I'm looking at Sean in Denver, Colorado, and I think he's been waiting on the phone almost the whole show. It just happens sometimes. It's that just the way the calls go. But Sean in Denver, if you're there with us, thanks for being patient and waiting, and you can go ahead with your question for Jimmy.
Yeah, no problem. Thanks so much for taking my call. So I was wondering, I've been doing the St. Joseph consecration, and it got me thinking, since we know that Mary is the only person besides Jesus who was without sin, do we have any sort of account of St. Joseph sinning, or any idea of what St. Joseph sinning might have looked like?
We don't have an explicit statement that Joseph ever sinned. The statement that we have is that he was a righteous man, which is consistent with a person also committing sins at various points in their life, as long as their dominant attitude is one of righteousness. The only thing I can think of off the top of my head that you might try to use to argue that Joseph was a sinner is when he learns that Mary is pregnant. He initially plans to divorce her quietly, rather than put her to a public shame. And you could somehow claim that the fact he doesn't realize that that she has not been unfaithful to him is some kind of moral stain. However, there are a couple of problems with that. The first problem is that Matthew himself presents the plan to divorce Mary quietly as a righteous act, because the alternative is to putting her to public shame, and he's so righteous he doesn't want to do that. So he's sensitive to her needs and her reputation and so forth. The other problem is this doesn't seem to indicate a problem of the will. It's an information problem. And even Mary herself could fail to understand certain things about Jesus and his ministry. We see that in Luke chapter 2, where Jesus has been left behind in Jerusalem, and Mary, like Joseph, does not initially realize he's not with us, so they misunderstand that. And then they don't immediately realize, oh, he's got to be in the temple, so let's go there first. And because when she gets there, she says, don't you know that your father and I have been searching for you, indicating this was not the first place they went. So it was possible even for Mary to lack information and have incorrect perceptions of these things without her sinning. And in the same way, it would be possible for Joseph to have an incorrect understanding of what the situation was with Mary and how she became pregnant without Joseph sinning. So being mistaken about something intellectually is not the same thing as committing a sin.
Okay, Sean?
Yeah, thanks so much.
All right, thank you very much. Let's go to Brookfield, Wisconsin. Watching on YouTube Live is David. David, I think you've been waiting a long time as well. Thank you for your patience. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy. No?
It's good to be on the show. My question is that I've heard a lot recently that, especially from like libertarians and like even some conservatives, that they see the Catholic Church as this like oppressive group that like limits people's individual freedoms. And I was wondering if you had any counter arguments to that, or any like ways to counter argue against that.
It's interesting that you say that you've heard such things from libertarians and conservatives. In my experience, it tends to be people from the more progressive end of the spectrum who usually argue the Catholic Church as oppressive limiter of personal freedom. There are a number of things that I could point you to. One of them, I deal with some of this in one of the entries in my book, A Daily Defense, which I don't know, maybe we can send to David's side.
Yeah, we can.
For a somewhat more full argumentation. But basically, if think about your own life experience as a Catholic, I mean, how often does the Catholic Church determine your decisions and deny you freedom? I mean, one thing that some people will point out is, well, the Catholic Church has these moral teachings. Okay, fine. Do moral teachings of their nature limit people's freedom? Well, from a certain point of view, I mean, they tell you don't be immoral, but then there's another question, should we be immoral people in the first place? And anybody who has moral values, and that would include progressives and libertarians and conservatives, anybody who has moral values should say, well, no, we should be moral people. So we can maybe have disagreements about what does morality require, but saying we ought to be moral does not infringe on anybody's liberty, because we don't have liberty to just go do immoral things, however you envision those, whether you think it's immoral to be racist or sexist or whatever it may be. We don't have moral liberty to go do those things because they're wrong. So if you then step back from the question of morality and say, okay, well, what other rules does the Catholic Church have? Well, it actually has vastly less than the United States does. If you look at the U.S. Federal code of law, it's just volume after volume after volume of detailed regulations that overregulate everything in our lives. Whereas the Catholic Church has the Code of Canon Law, which is, you know, it's a book, it's like an inch and a half thick, and most of it doesn't even apply to ordinary Catholics, because most of it is dealing with detailed procedures that that ordinary Catholics never even encounter. So what kind of rules, other than a moral nature, does an average Catholic encounter? Well, let's see. Go to church on Sunday. Get married in the church or get a dispensation to have a non-Catholic marriage. If you have mortal sin, go to confession once a year. Do what you can to support the preaching of the gospel. You know, it's very basic stuff like this. You know, get baptized and confirmed. All of this is very basic. It's actually a very minimal imposition on people's activity. Some would say we maybe even ought to strengthen the level of engagement that Catholics should have with the church and with their faith. But the idea that the church is systematically denying people liberty is frankly a joke. Other than moral commandments, the requirements the church makes for individual Catholics in their life are really, really moderate.
Okay. David?
All right. I thank you for the answer then.
Well, you
I just want to let you know that I'm... What?
No, I was just going to say that you should hang on because if you'd like, we'll get your address and we'll send you a copy of Jimmy's book, A Daily Defense. But go ahead with the point you were going to make.
Yeah, I was just about to say I'm a huge fan of Catholic Answers, and first time I heard about it, I was like, what? And yeah, it's just been a huge help for me defending my faith, and I really appreciate that, you know, that you guys do your work, and it's I appreciate it so much.
Well, I have to say, when people hear about us, like, what? That's a common response. I do think that's very common, and that is very sweet of you to say it. Thank you, David. I think we got time for another one, Jimmy. Do you think we got time for another one? I think so.
Sure.
Who can we get to? Maybe even two more. You never know. Let's go to Harry in Salem, Massachusetts. Okay, watching on the or listening on the Catholic Answers Live app. Harry, glad to have you. Go ahead with your question for Jimmy Akin.
Sure. I've been a Catholic all my life, and recently. I've noticed this this doctor on YouTube, Dr. Fred Tarsitano, who and his family were Roman Catholics all their lives, but he stopped being a Catholic after he heard a number of different things about the Catholic religion.
Is there one that's I just don't want to get too much into this person that I don't know. So, Harry, is there one that's bothering you? You can just give it to Jimmy and he'll handle it.
Right here, it's from the King James Holy Bible, Revelation 18, 4 and 5.
And it says?
It says. It says, and I heard another voice from heaven saying, "Come out of her, my people, that you be not partakers of her sins, and that you receive not of her plagues." And then 5, "For her sins have reached unto heaven, and God hath remembered her iniquities." So that scared me, and then I started looking at other segments that he has on YouTube.
Are you worried that that's the Catholic Church that he's referring to?
This is a common claim in some anti-Catholic circles that the Whore of Babylon in the Book of Revelation is the Catholic Church. And there are a bunch of ways to show that's false. One that I'll mention is that the Whore of Babylon is depicted in the Book of Revelation as having persecuted apostles and prophets. Well, if it's the Catholic Church, which anti-Catholics claim did not exist in the first century, how could it possibly persecute apostles since they were only around in the first century? Now, there's a lot more to say about the Whore of Babylon and why it's not the Catholic Church. But for that, I'll recommend to you some more detailed reading that you can go over and digest and have time to think about. And that's an article that I wrote quite a number of years ago called Hunting the Whore of Babylon. And so if you Google Jimmy Akin, Hunting the Whore of Babylon, or if you also Google Jimmy Akin, Who is the Whore, these articles should come up. One of them, you'll find them both at Catholic.com, and you'll find them at JimmyAkin.com. And it'll go through this whole issue in a lot more detail than we're able to really do on the air.
Those are some good titles for those articles, though, Jimmy. Harry, I hope that that's helpful. Maybe you can call back with follow-up questions. Jimmy, you've got a book that'll come out. I don't know when it'll come out, but you just finished it on anti-Catholic myths. Is the Whore of Babylon one in there?
The Whore is there are some related issues. The Whore is not specifically there, but some things like papal antichrist theory is. Also, I deal with this in my book, A Daily Defense. Maybe we could send that to him if he's still on the line.
Hey, Harry, if you're on the line, hang on the line. We'll send you A Daily Defense. That's a great idea. We'll get that out to you and maybe read up on it and call back as you have more questions on this topic. We're happy to take them. And you know what? We're going to be here doing this for another hour. So if you're on the line, please stay on the line. We'll get to your question right when we come back. Jimmy Akin is our guest for the next hour as well as this hour. And if you haven't dialed yet and you've got a question about the Catholic faith, Catholic people, Catholic tradition, or anything else, you're welcome to call 888-318-7884, 888-318-7884. Right back with more Open Forum with Jimmy Akin on Catholic Answers Live.